Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
August 9th.
On August the 9th, 18-year-old Michael Brown was gunned down by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri.
Ferguson has been in turmoil after a white police officer shot dead an unarmed black teenager.
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
If we don't get it,
shut it down! We do this for Mike Brown! Turn up the
There's not really a conscious political voice in battle rap. It's a way to reach people.
It is, man. About to make a political move in my city. I'm about to run for state representative.
Remember, I'm the one that went from being pepper sprayed and tear gas to being sworn in.
That is an excerpt from the new documentary St. Louis Superman. It is a portrait of Bruce Franks Jr., a 35-year-old battle rapper and Ferguson activist, turned state representative from St. Louis, Missouri. It is a look at an issue that has played out across this nation, Los Angeles, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., New York, and other places, incidents that spark civil unrest and activism. But this is a story about how we respond after that. But joining me to talk about this are former Missouri State Representative Bruce Franks Jr. and Posey Tang, producer of St. Louis Superman and commissioning editor for Witness Al Jazeera. Lines are open if you have a comment or a question about this at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Bruce, Poe, thank you both for coming in. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me first start with Ferguson, August 9th, 2014. Where were you, Bruce, when you heard about the killing of Michael Brown?
I was actually, I was blowing up balloons for my son's first birthday. And we were just getting ready to celebrate his first birthday because his birthday is on August the 9th. And I was looking on social media. My social media started going crazy. And a good friend of mine, Tef Poe, had a post with the man we now know to be Michael Brown Jr.'s stepfather. Had a cardboard that said, Ferguson police just killed my son. And it hit me, but it didn't hit me, right? It's like, again, because we've seen this in St. Louis. We've seen this other places. And then probably a couple minutes later, I just started getting tagged in all these pictures. And I got on there and I saw Michael Brown's body in the middle of the street. And something in me just said I needed to go. Because before that, I wasn't an activist. I wasn't, you know, that just wasn't me. And so something in me said go, and I went out there.
Mm-hmm. Before Michael Brown's killing, what were you doing? And when I don't mean that moment, but what were you doing in your life? What was happening for you in your life right there? Were you working? Were you mm-hmm. in school? What was happening?
So I was always a rapper, mm-hmm. Especially locally, kind of known, and had two businesses. I was married at the time. Life was okay for me. Had already gone through a lot of gun violence and trauma in my life, but as we know in black communities, it became, you know, I became desensitized. You know, it was every day, so it was like take it and roll. And so, yeah, that's what I was doing. I was just trying to make a living and out in the community still a little bit, but not like nothing like this, nothing like where I would be just a day after.
And in that day after, you just said after seeing all of this activity on social media, you said, I knew I had to go. Go where and why?
So go to the streets where the people were. I saw that folks were forming. I knew I probably knew a good portion of people that would be out there.
Because Ferguson is not a big place.
No, Ferguson is not a big place, and it's not far from the city of St. Louis. It's not far from other municipalities. And so I went out there. And when I got out there, I quickly realized why I came out there. To see the amount of people that were out there, to see the diverse setting of people, of all creeds, all makeups, all religions, kind of feeling the same way. But I remember when it got darker and the police showed up, and it reminded me of every single Black history program or film that we had seen when police show up with police dogs and they form their line. And so that kind of triggered me, too, because I wasn't an activist. I didn't consider myself an activist or a revolutionary or nothing like that. But I got pissed off. And rightfully so with the rest of the people. And that kind of just, it just went from there. And I didn't stop. I didn't leave. And I just elevated from there.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking to Bruce Franks Jr. He is the focus of a new documentary, St. Louis Superman, about political activism, his own, and in a broader sense, a look at Black political activism some 5 years later after the killing of Michael Brown in St. Louis, Ferguson, Missouri. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I saw the film last night as part of the Meet the Press film event last night. One of the things that I found interesting during the course of the film, you said, if someone had told me, 4 or 5 years ago that I would be an elected official or an activist, I paraphrase, you said I would have thought they were crazy. What was the thing specifically about the Michael Brown incident that moved you to run for office instead of just remaining an activist?
So it was the people. It was the community. It was the other activists. It was the folks that were out in Ferguson that we all, after being out there so many days, right, it was a question amongst us, not everybody else, because we really didn't listen to too much what everybody else was saying about what we were doing. But it was a question among us is like, how are we going to elevate this? Like, what are we going to do next? How are we going to get substantial change in the community? Because we're going to continue to march and show up and shut it down and whatever else we need to do, but what else can we do? So some of us became executive directors of organizations. Some people went and worked in different realms of the social fight, and we started we just started working in the streets. And then somebody had an idea, like, some of us do need to run for office. And my community was kind of saying the same thing at the same time as the activists, right? And that's kind of what sparked it. And at that point, it was like, yeah, I'm here for the people. I'm here to represent the people. So that's all that really mattered to me. So if I got to run for office to do that, to get substantial change, although I know nothing about this office. Before this, I wasn't an avid voter. I didn't care about politics. I didn't care about any of this because I looked around my community and I saw the same thing. And I had people that was representing me that looked like me for years and years and years and years. And I just looked at the total political structure like, okay, well, what is voting benefited anybody? That's mm-hmm. That was my thought process. But once the people said run, the people who I'm so close to and I give my life for, it's like, all right, well, if that's what's gonna make sense, if that's what we need to do, then that's what we're gonna do.
Poe, how did you get wind of this story? Why did you decide to tell this story?
So as a commissioning editor for a show called Witness, Al Jazeera English, we look for strong character-driven journeys that will teach us something about the world that we live in. And I look after U.S., Canada, and Latin America, so all the documentaries for Witness.
A small area.
That's pretty small. and so, I'm always looking for stories that are thematically relevant today, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, it's going to be relevant 20 years from now. And so the theme has to be both timely and timeless. And when you're looking at Black Lives Matter and movements that emerged after Trayvon Martin, after what happened in Ferguson, after what happened in Baltimore to Freddie Gray, Alton Sterling, I guess what I was thinking at that time, and this was maybe 2 years ago now, 2.5 years ago now, movements like Black Lives Matter, can it translate, transform into actual change in policy? And the thinking was, of course it can. But now, can we find a character, a compelling subject for which we can go on a journey with and understand it in a deeper way?
How did you hear about Bruce?
So there was this one filmmaker, director, her name is Smriti Mundra, and I'd seen some of her work. She made this excellent documentary called A Suitable Girl, observational verite documentary, and I was dying to work with her. So I reached out to her and I asked her, is there anything you would like to pitch to witness Al Jazeera English? And so she pitched the story of Bruce Franks Jr. She sent me a clip of Bruce battle rapping and his Twitter page. And we knew that this was the, you know, this was the story that would teach us all something.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the documentary St. Louis Superman, The Portrait of Bruce Franks Jr., a former Missouri State Representative from St. Louis who was inspired by the death and the aftermath of Michael Brown. If you have a comment, if you have a question, and certainly if you are thinking perhaps about political activism or making a difference, I'd like to hear from you as well. Give us a call again at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. How did you react when you first heard from Poe about wanting to tell your story?
So I actually had the great pleasure of meeting Poe a little later. Smriti Mundra, one of the filmmakers, that's who first got in contact with me, and she tracked me down. I mean, Facebook, Twitter, wherever, she smoke signals, you know.
She harassed him.
Yeah, carrier pigeon.
Yeah, she yeah. She stalked me. And finally, my legislative assistant Danielle, who's my best friend as well, one of my best friends. She's really into like world news and like she gets it. So she's like, do you know this is from Al Jazeera? And I was like, I don't know him.
Who is Al?
Yeah. Right. And she was like, no, don't worry about it. I'll check it out. I was like, you check it out. If it's, you know, if we should do it, then we're going to do it. So she, about 45 minutes later, she came back and she was like, yeah, they the real deal. You should do this. I'm going to go ahead and vouch for them. I talked to the filmmaker. I think it's a great idea. And first time I talked to Smriti, she just made me feel comfortable about telling my story and telling our story, more importantly, right? The story of the people, not just Ferguson activists, but Black fathers and folks who are in this movement that do this each and every day, that are going through struggles, you know, all the struggles that they may be going through. She allowed me to tell the story, and she allowed the story to kind of manifest and tell itself, and that was very important.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tracy, calling from Woodbridge, Virginia. Thanks for calling. Quickly, what's on your mind?
Yes, how you doing? I'm calling about to ask the young brothers why he's not still in the office. He said former. As you can see right now, as the politics going on through the world, do you think him not being in the office again or not knowing about voting at the time, he still should be in the office right now, trying to still make that change instead of leaving?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. That was a great question. So I actually resigned due to severe mental health issues that I was going through with anxiety and depression. I lost my best friend and my brother. And then I lost my godson, who was 16, within 90 days of each other, both to gun violence.
Okay.
And I really... Yeah, and I actually realized that politics is for patient people who understand that the change takes time.
Right.
And given I'm a young black man with a loud voice, we know what our life expectancy usually is when it comes to politics. So I would rather force that change right now because I'm impatient about black lives. And I would rather work with those who are patient enough to be in office and get the job done.
Thank you so much, Tracy, for that that question. We need to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Bruce Franks Jr. and Posey King. And as we talk about black political activism and the documentary St. Louis Superman, if you are on the line, stay with us. Don't hang up. You will be able to hear the conversation in 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This conversation continues on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking about the documentary St. Louis Superman and black political activism. My guests are former Missouri State Representative Bruce Franks Jr. and Posey Ting, producer of St. Louis Superman and commissioning editor for Witness Al Jazeera. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Zero. Bruce, help me a bit with something that I heard also in the film last night. You mentioned in the film that you had attended with more than 160 funerals. Is that correct?
Now 200.
200. And at the time, in what space of time had you attended these funerals?
So starting 1991, that was the first funeral I've attended, which was my brother, who was killed when he was 9 years old. He was used as a human shield. And from then on, it's just being in a community that you grow up in, to the point where when I became adult and after Michael Brown was killed, I started mentoring, I started working with programs. So it's a lot of young men with, you know, with struggles, right, that we deal with each and every day. I was losing my young men that were in a program. I was losing folks that were close to me. And up until, you know, just recently, a couple years ago, you just now really get to understand that this ain't normal, right? You grow out through life and it seems regular because it happens so much and nobody really talks about it or nobody really dwells on it, or we don't tap into that trauma or that PTSD that comes along with, you know, those funerals and what happened. And just recently I've been able to kind of identify, like, it's time to get some help. It's time to talk to some, it's time to figure it out. But it's time to talk about it out loud, especially when it comes to the black community.
200 funerals now is unusual in any kind of situation, whether it's, you know, 1991 mm-hmm. or 1981, that is a lot of death and a lot of grief. While you were in office, you had a bill mm-hmm. about youth violence and the impact on the community. Talk to me about that, because that was in the film last night, and I thought that was a really fascinating piece of legislation to hang your hat on.
Right. So the CDC had already said that violence was a public health epidemic, but you never hear about that. You know, we're talking about our Center for Disease Control, and so I kind of took that with a bunch of stats that I already knew about violence and gun violence when it comes to youth. and identified it as a public health epidemic, because that's exactly what it is. These young folks aren't dying and aren't killing folks because they just want to wake up, rob, steal, and kill. You know, it's the fact that there are lack of jobs, resources, education, and all these different things in our community. Undiagnosed mental health issues that we don't know about. So many kids suffering from depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, a million different things when we've just been told, oh, be strong, or, you know, you'll figure it out, or nah, you just tired, whatever. But now to know that we identify violence as a public health epidemic, it helps release funding in key areas when people want to talk about the root cause of gun violence. And also being in a Republican state that I served in, that was the quickest way to get something done about gun violence without necessarily talking about the gun, because, you know, that's a no starter for them. Mm-hmm. Right. And their Second Amendment and so on and so forth. So that's a no starter for them. And we still got kids dying. Each and every day, we got kids messing up their lives by committing these crimes as well. So we thought, and I had some help from the House, help from some of my colleagues, to put this together and to get this done and get it across the finish line. And eventually it passed in the Senate, passed out of the House, but it passed the Senate unanimously. Mm-hmm. And was signed into law last year.
Paul, what was the thing that surprised you most about this story and this film as you were going through the producing process?
So I look after U.S., Canada, and Latin America, these regions, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember a list that came out last year on cities with the highest murder rates across the world. I believe it was like top 50 cities. Many of the cities are from Venezuela, Brazil, Mexico. Guess where St. Louis ranks?
I can't imagine.
Number 13.
Mm.
St. Louis has had the highest murder rate per capita for years. And it was shocking to me that I didn't know about it. And it was shocking that I got it. And even in this past summer, how many kids now, Bruce, have been killed in the streets?
Over 24.
Over 24 kids have been killed in St. Louis, and not much and not enough coverage, I would say, has been done about it. And so it was definitely the story that we had to tell. But how do you tell a story that doesn't, again, sort of go into the conventional storylines and conventional narratives and conventional tropes about people who are going through so much because of poverty, because of so many things that stacked up against them? And so it was just, you know, we were so lucky when Smriti and Sammy came to us and said, you know, we want to make a documentary and we want to tell the story with Bruce Franks Jr. about his life. And at Witness, I personally never want to work with filmmakers who want to tell stories of or about people.
But what do you mean by that?
Looking for filmmakers who are going to tell stories with their subjects. Because the type of stories that we do are observational, directional verite films, so no sit-down interviews, unfolding human drama. That means the filmmaker, filmmakers in this case, Smriti and Sammy, they have to be able to develop that bond and trust with their subject. And that means telling stories with. And so I had the great privilege of working with them. Mm-hmm. And what always struck me, even from the very beginning, both Sammy and Smriti are such good listeners. And so as they were making this film, they didn't have a set structure or this is how we're going to tell Bruce's story in the course of X amount of months. They were always asking questions and they always wanted to learn. And working with them, I learned through them. And also I learned through you, Bruce, in the past few months.
When you were elected, did you have an idea about what you wanted to do?
So actually, yes. And it's funny you said that, because I went back and sometimes I look at like my old interviews before I was elected, like right when I was running, some of my interviews I did in the paper, and I talked about gun violence from the root cause. I talked about violence from the root cause. I talked about summer jobs. I talked about all of these things that I end up doing. I end up putting $9.5 million, with the help of my colleagues, of course, $9.5 million into the budget for summer jobs. I passed legislation. I passed amendments on legislation, and a lot of the things that I said I wanted to do, I end up doing. And even outside of that, I was still the person I said I was going to be. I remember an interview, I said, you know, God forbid something else tragic happened, but if I'm elected and I have to hit the streets and be in the front lines, that's what I'm going to do. And in 2017, the Stockley verdict came through and we had to organize again. And I was in the front lines.
For those who aren't familiar, give me the brief on the Stockley verdict.
Oh, Jason Stockley was the officer who murdered Anthony Lamar Smith. To say discrepancies would be a slap in the face with the case. Planted weapons, I mean, clear video evidence of this murder, unjustified, and he was let off. And so we decided to organize. And with this organizing, it was a little different because it was those folks who were in the front lines of Ferguson who didn't necessarily have a microphone at first during Ferguson. Right. So we all kind of learned from that, and we came together and we all led. We all organized. I may have been in the front a lot of the times or been the face on the news, but it was led by a bunch of frontliners who got pepper spray and tear gas during Ferguson. And we affected change, you know, even in that moment. But when it came to blocking the highway, right, I was out there. I got locked up. When it came to Black Friday protests, I got locked up in the mall, you know, as a elected official. And that's what I told you I was going to do. But it's not like I'm doing it intentionally. This is who I am. You know, I'm not trying to do anything. Like, this is just who I'm going to show up for my people. No matter what capacity I'm in, and I never changed who I was.
About showing up for your people, in the documentary, during a rap battle that you had with another guy, there was entertaining, yes.
Yeah.
But I think it showed a split, and tell me if I'm overstepping here, but before you were elected, you were probably more like him as a rapper.
Oh, yes.
And looking at the need for change, but often only just complaining about it through the art.
Yeah.
And then you became part of what he accused you of being part of the system, and depending on how you look at it, you could be part of the system or you could be working within the system to change.
Right. And I get where you're going, but I wouldn't call it complaining.
Mm-hmm.
I would call it just voicing that frustration, right?
Okay.
Especially for an area that you don't know much about. You know how you feel about it, right? And your only way of saying anything about it could be this platform. Right. To get people to understand where you're coming from,
which is really the history of hip hop in and of itself.
Absolutely.
That's another show.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
Right. But go ahead.
And so but I enjoy that because he bought the perspective of it's some folks who feel like that. And when I'm able to rebuttal that and say, hey, I feel what you're saying, but this is what I've done. This is what I'm going to continue to do. And there's a way to work inside the system and outside the system, and I show how to work inside and outside at the same time. It proved to be tiresome, it proved to be depressing, it proved to be very heavy, but there's a way that we can do it. And so being able to have that platform and me come from, you know, being in that mindset before and now, you know, changing my mindset and understanding a little more about just the whole structure, being able to voice that on this wide platform where I'm going to have 100,000 people, a million people watching me on YouTube. Now I get to say something, right? I get to be, this is my taking a knee, right? On the football field. This is me using the biggest platform I have, to exercise my First Amendment and to get folks to understand exactly why we fight and exactly what I'm doing and why I ran for office, why I'm still here, why I left office, you know, why I'll continue to fight in a different realm. And it's, yeah, but that was probably outside of my kids, you know, that was my favorite scene in the entire, cause it gives you another look into my life, but it gives you another look at battle rap and how important it is and can be, to our culture as a whole, not just hip hop, but politics, activism, you know, when we talk about message.
You discussed about the loss of your brother earlier, and of course during the course of the film last night. I spoke to several friends about this last night and today, because you speak to your friends, and they said, so what are you doing today on your show? That's what people ask. And I say, I'm going to be, you know, interviewing this brother, Bruce Franks, who is Bruce Franks, blah, blah, blah. Explain mm-hmm. who you were. But then I spoke about the murder of your brother. Mm-hmm. And the response was always, OMG, oh my God, that is horrible, blah, blah, blah. What became of the men involved or responsible for the death of your brother, if you know?
One is locked up, and I think he'll be locked up for the rest of his life. I'm actually going to tell you something too that I haven't told anybody. The man that held my brother up, he got released after, I think it was 25 years. He got released. I sent him a message on Facebook. And to sum it up, I just talked about the need for black men to be present in the community. Those who have fallen kind of down that path, you know, to show that, to rectify, right? To try to rectify, to do something. Because my brother's life wasn't in vain, right? I'm gonna make sure that, you know, my family's gonna make sure that, but he needs to do the same. I don't like a lot of things when it comes to this justice system, but at the end of the day, the time that was given to him, he served. 6 years ago, I would have felt totally different. But, and not to go too far off, but it reminded me of when Botham Jean's brother, right, his actions towards the police officer. I wouldn't have did it, but I understand. Because forgiveness wasn't about her. It wasn't about... you know, he felt, I know how he felt with his brother being taken away. It was more so for him, right? And that's how I felt. And I wasn't at that level of forgiveness, I ain't gonna lie. But this conversation with him, this message to him, whether he read it or not, because after that, I blocked him.
Okay.
You know, because I don't want a response. I just need you to hear what I'm gonna say. And I need you to understand how important it is for you to the day that you die, to try to right your wrongs.
If he came to you and found you and wanted to have a conversation about that day and where he is now, wherever it may be, would you sit down with him?
I don't know. You know, I could give the diplomatic answer. Yes, no, I don't know. It would depend on the day, the time, the feeling, what's going on in life. Like it, you know, that because that's heavy. But I don't want you to talk to me though. Like I need you to call my stepmother. Right, I need you to call Sil and see if she want to talk to you. I need you to call, you know, that's who I need you to call to see if you want to talk to. Not me. I said what I had to say in reality. But Chris's mother, you know, my father, you know, that's who he would need to talk to. And I don't know if she's, I don't know if she's there or she will ever be there. Mm-hmm. Rightfully so. And so that's realistically probably not, because I think I said what I need to say.
You left your state house seat, and in the movie it mentions that you were under immense mental stress. There was depression. You left for mental health reasons. Talk to me about when you began to realize that you weren't going to stay, and specifically why.
I started to think about it in August when Sylvester, who's my best friend, I mean, blood couldn't have made us no closer. He's the best man in my wedding. Like, when I used to get in trouble, you know, right out of high school, when he was in college, it was him.
There's always a Sylvester for all of us, man. Yes.
He's my right and left hand. And when we hadn't talked in a while, because I was just so busy. In my mind, I was busy, right? I was so busy, and I hadn't talked to him in so long. And I was with Michael Brown Sr. We were, Michael Brown wanted to shut down Ferguson Market for 30 days. And so we were doing it, right? And I remember, you know, fiving him up, giving him a hug, like, all right, I'm out of here. I'm finna go see my little sister. And walking to my car, they called me and told me that Sylvester had died. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I would never wish death on anybody, but out of all the people in the world, out of all the people in my life, like, Sylvester's the last person that you would think, right? And after the funeral, after everything happened, it hit me, like, I've helped so many people that I don't know. And there was my brother, my best friend, who needed me. And I was nowhere to be found. If he would have called me, I probably wouldn't have known. I probably wouldn't have known because I didn't have his number.
How did he die?
Gun violence.
Okay.
And at that point, it's like I'm helping all these folks that I don't know. I'm losing the folks that I love most. I went into the darkest place I probably ever been. And so I was in that place. I was trying to climb out. And one of the things that was helping me climb out was this film and the crew, because we became family. And then the day after Thanksgiving, my best friend, Lisa, she calls me frantic. I can't understand what's going on. So my goddaughter, Myja, gets on the phone and she tells me where they at. So I go there. And at the time, I have a Republican with me. I got Nate Tate. Representative Nate Tate, good friend of mine. He's a Republican.
Is this the gentleman who was also in the documentary?
No.
Okay.
No. And so I had him with me. And, you know, we were just going to sit there and talk about some upcoming plans, but really just because we were friends in real life. And so I told him, I said, I don't know what's going on, but you can go ahead, head back if you want. He said, no, I'm going to go with you. And we went out there. And when I pulled up, I saw my best friend Lisa on the ground crying. And I saw my godson laying there. Ambulance hadn't even got there yet. And I remember grabbing my friend Lisa and talking to her, because now I'm in work mode instead of being able to grieve, because I need to be strong for her. I need to make sure these young folks who are upset, you know, I need to, you know. And I remember she told me, she said, best friend, I never asked you for nothing. She said, but we call you Superman for a reason. So if anybody can bring my son back, you can. And that, I was crushed. Like, after that, it was like I started questioning everything that I was doing, because it's like I lost Sylvester. Now I done lost, you know, his nickname was Daddy. That's what we called him. I done lost Sylvester. I lost Daddy. Like, and there's nothing I could do about it. Like, it's nothing I could do. And that was at the height And after his funeral, I remember I stayed in the house for, I probably stayed in the house for like a week, week and a half. And at the end of that week and a half, I remember writing a suicide note. And fortunately, you know, I'm still here. But that's when it hit me that I probably don't need to do this. Fought through it the next couple weeks because session was about to start in January. Fought through it. Started session. And this was, like, out of all my three sessions that I was able to serve, this was the worst one. It just came with so much. It came with so much turmoil. It came with so many lies. It came with the things that they do to black folks in power when they don't want you to be in power no more. When you got too much power, when you have too much, we have too many people following. When you're doing the right thing, right? That's what came about. And it got to the point by March, I was like, I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. Like, I'm not finna keep subjecting myself to this. And I made that decision, and today it's been one of the best decisions I've ever made.
You left the legislature, but you eventually left Missouri as a sense of, as a form of self-care.
Absolutely.
You're in Arizona now. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling very good. I'm not in Arizona.
Oh, you're not? Okay.
It's all good.
Okay.
But I feel very good. I'm the healthiest I ever been. When I was in office, I weighed 135 pounds, and now I weigh 170 and feel like I'm 10 years ago. Right. I can move around.
Fighting weight.
Yeah. I'm good now. They in trouble. They ain't never seen me at 100%. But I feel so good mentally. Still have great relationships with my family, still, you know, close to my kids. That'll never change. But I just feel good. I feel really good. And for the first time in a long time, not only am I okay, but I can look in the mirror and recognize myself.
Poe, what do you want people to take away from this documentary?
I think back about everything I've learned from working on this film with Smriti and Sammy and Bruce. And the biggest thing that I've learned is don't judge and listen. And maybe you'll learn something. And that's what I got out of it. And I hope our audience will too.
Would you run for office again wherever you decide to go?
No.
Not at all?
Not at all. I'll be the first one to help and ignite those who are ready to run for office. Those who I feel can make a change in office, because I feel like I kind of know, right? Like, if somebody is, you know, to be successful, I think I can help them get mentally prepared for what's coming, because that's one thing we miss out on. Folks don't get us mentally prepared for what this is, and the toll it might take. Everything I came into the House of Representatives with, I left without. I was married, got a divorce, house, businesses, left and had to have a fresh start. And so I can help folks. You know, I feel like I can ignite. I can be St. Louis Superman, or I can go around the United States and ignite Baltimore, St. Louis, you know, Baltimore Superman, Baltimore Superwoman, Detroit, Chicago, New York, wherever it is, right? D.C., that's what I could do. And I feel like that can be more effective because, like I said, politics is for patient people. And I am very impatient when it comes to black lives. So I can disrupt and get change a lot faster than I can passing legislation.
I seem to remember a statement from Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King about why we can't wait. And yet the the name St. Louis Superman, maybe you can still, you know, as you said, do that, or at least tell the next ones where the kryptonite is.
Absolutely. And I think that's what's something that's so telling about the name Superman, because most people think about, you know, him as a superhero, right? Only. But forget he had to be Clark Kent. He had to work, and he still had kryptonite.
Bruce Franks Jr., Posey Ting, thank you all so very, very much. I really appreciate you coming and spending some time again. Congratulations on the documentary. Information about that documentary will be posted on our website on WHUR.com. As always, after 8:30. Again, good luck to you, good health to you, and thank you all very much.
Thank you so much.
That is the Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141 for this Tuesday, October 8th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.